he said that this revolution, meaning the Islamic revolution, of Iran, is not known in the entire globe without the name of Khomeini. And that's true, and we can talk about this again.
So thanks very much for that, Dr. Hassani. Honestly, on that note, we'll finish this session, and hopefully in the next session, we're going to look at the context of Iran, particularly in terms of its region, in terms of globally.
We have to get to more issues.
More issues, and then look at, you know, again, this divine personality, how he has really impacted on the complete reversal of the role that Iran had in the past, as opposed to what it is today. But thanks, listeners, for listening to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. I hope you enjoyed it, this session today.
And
it
still is.
And still is, as Dr. Hassani says. But I want to thank him for this session and for his valuable contribution on the program. And God willing, we'll see you in the next session very soon. May the peace and mercy of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Long delay due to the pandemic, Euro 2020 finally kicks off in Rome, and football lovers all over the world are in a fever. Now, a French baker living in Germany has also seized the moment to create special pastries for the championships. Ludovic Gerboin is a huge football fan. He has made sweets for all the teams present in this year's Euros, but most of his cakes are inspired by the French and German flags. He has mixed bakery traditions from different countries to capture the multinational spirit of the tournament. Ludovic hopes his country of origin, France, will lift the much-coveted cup, but he is also favouring Germany. Now, a lot of people don't like rats and find them disgusting most of the time. However, the rodents are doing life-saving work in Cambodia. Now, the Southeast Asian nation has deployed a new squad of African giant pouched rats to sniff out old landmines. The new recruits have shown an exceptional ability at their task, with their handlers claiming 100% accuracy. There are now nearly 50 demining rats working in the field in Cambodia. The country started using the animal services in 2016, and they have helped detect and clear hundreds of landmines since. Last year, an especially heroic rat called Magawa attracted global fame after receiving a gold medal for his work. The hero rat, who is now retired, detected over 71 landmines.
A muralist from Greece is blending mythology with graffiti and street art to depict how COVID-19 has impacted lives around the globe. Ficus Antonios has painted the walls of many cities around the globe. He is now in the Cypriot capital, Nicosia, to continue his work. His latest artwork depicts Americus, a Cypriot mythical figure who was punished by the gods and turned into a plant. The Greek artist believes this theme is similar to the situation people around the globe have experienced since the pandemic began. He explains many people have grown roots because they're staying in one place for so long. Two British artists have brought a combination of fun, art, and environmental concerns to the sidelines of the G7 summit. They have created a modern-day version of famous sculpture carved into America's Mount Rushmore. This time, it's called Mount Recyclemore. Joe Rush and Alex Rakish have made a sculpture of G7 leaders with electronic waste. They say their major goal is to raise awareness about the amount of unrecycled tech and gadgets, the damage they cause to the environment, and the ways to combat the issue internationally.
Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders of the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan that we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste and how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we've put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, a while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in its thousands. A tiny worm has wriggled back to life after lying frozen for 24,000 years in the permafrost land of northern Siberia. The organism was recovered from soil samples taken from 3.5 meters below the ground in Russia's Yakutia region. It's a multicellular organism that can withstand extreme cold. This ancient worm has broken the record for the longest living abeloid rotifer worm. Previous research suggests that it could survive for a decade when frozen. Earlier, scientists also discovered 30,000-year-old microscopic worms from northern Siberia.
Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Erromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran, but when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting, like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. The Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wook is a 28-year-old industrial engineer or designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Pang says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see their third eye.
As the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc in India, some auto rickshaw drivers have turned their three-wheelers into makeshift ambulances to provide patients with first aid services.
In New Delhi, the municipal ambulances are often occupied. There are also some very narrow alleys or built-up areas that are inaccessible by regular-sized ambulances. In these cases, our makeshift ambulances came in handy then. We attend to people in need with oxygen cylinders.
Mishra, who started the Rickshaw Ambulance Initiative, says his center attends around 1,200 calls per day. He says rickshaw volunteers transport roughly 150 patients during peak hours. The brave drivers work 12-hour shifts and mainly serve people with mild symptoms. They wear full protective gear, including face shields, while on duty. The three-wheeler ambulances are easily identifiable by the large printed image of the fleet and emergency call numbers. Mishra says the fleet will continue running with all its might until the coronavirus is under full control in India. In Russia, drone enthusiasts have gathered in the capital, Moscow, to show off their technological creativity in a racing competition. The participants created their own drones and made changes to the models right on the site where the competition was held to improve their chances to win the contest. The goal was for the participants to complete the track in the shortest possible time. Participants say the interesting thing about the competition is that it's cheaper than other games.
It's a lot of fun. From the outside, it may not be so clear, but when you're inside it, it becomes really fun to talk, race with the competitors, learn from their experience some new technological things. As for the high cost, it is expensive, but when compared with the snowboards and skis, it is really cheaper, but more expensive than knitting.
In 2017, the International Federation of Aeronautics, or FAI, announced drone racing as an official sport. In 2018, Russia's sports ministry included drone racing in all Russian register of sports with a class code F3U following the FAI classification.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Sørensen Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The findings released by the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and Drug Policy Alliance, DPA, showed that 83% of Americans say the war on drugs has failed. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanus Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Poll shows 83% of Americans believe so-called war on drugs an abject failure. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. New polling released recently reveals that an overwhelming majority of Americans think the so-called war on drugs is a total failure, underscoring broad support for a new approach that puts public health over criminalization and a militarized response to the illegal narcotics trade that has lasted for decades in the U.S. The findings released by the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and Drug Policy Alliance, DPA, showed that 83% of Americans say the war on drugs has failed. That assessment is felt similarly across party lines. 83% of Democrats expressed that view, as did 85% of independents and 82% of Republicans. Nearly two-thirds of respondents, that is about 65%, said it's time to end the war on drugs. The poll also found that 66% of voters support getting rid of criminal penalties for drug possession and reinvesting drug enforcement resources into treatment and addiction services. Similar percentages were seen in support for eliminating mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes. That is 64%, and for commuting or reducing the sentences of people incarcerated for drugs, 61%. A further finding was that 63% think drug use should be addressed as a public health issue compared to just 33% say it should be addressed as a criminal justice issue. The polling came just ahead of the 50th anniversary of President Richard Nixon's War on Drugs Declaration. On June 17, 1971, Nixon called drug abuse public enemy number one and said it must be met with an all-out offensive. Opponents of the approach say it's spared decades of widespread harms to people and communities both in the U.S. and worldwide. As a senator, Joe Biden promoted the war on drugs, but in his 2020 presidential campaign, sounded at different notes, calling instead for a public health approach to substance abuse. In January, just ahead of his inauguration, a coalition of more than 200 drug policy, healthcare, and other community-based organizations called on Biden to end the war on drugs, telling the then-incoming administration that the time for urgent bold change is now. Odio Fair, director of the ACLU's Justice Division, urged the president to make good on his campaign pledge in a statement pointing to the drug war's fueling of the incarceration crisis. Ofer said, on this 50th anniversary of the drug war, President Biden must take good on his campaign promises and take steps to begin dismantling the system of over-policing and mass incarceration that is endemic to the war on drugs. He added, today drug possession continues to be the number one arrest in the United States with more than 1.35 million arrests per year. Every 25 seconds, a person is arrested for possessing drugs for personal use, with black people disproportionately targeted by this over-policing. It's time to adopt a new approach that treats substance use as a public health issue rather than a criminal justice one. Ofer continued, adding, Biden, he said, can make headway in ending this harmful and racist war by commuting the sentences of people incarcerated in federal prison for drugs. According to DPA Executive Director Cassandra Frederick, the new poll shows a different reality, one where we treat people who use drugs with dignity and respect, and one where drugs are no longer an excuse for law enforcement to surveil, harass, assault, and even kill black, Latinx, and indigenous people is 100% possible. With the devastation of drug war plain to see, Frederick said, it should come as no surprise that Americans are ready for a drastically different approach. She said, we deserve to live in a world where the health and safety of our communities are paramount. And that means eliminating all the ways in which we are criminalized and building an alternative response to get the support and help we need, unquote.
Diplomatic relationship between the United States and its geopolitical rival Russia is severely strained. A series of tit-for-tat actions has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such actions date back to the 1980s, but they have escalated over the past years. In 2016, America expelled dozens of Russian intelligence operatives. In response, Moscow expelled more than 700 American diplomats the following year. Later, the U.S. ordered the closure of Russian consulates in San Francisco and Seattle. Russia ordered the closure of the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg in 2018. Earlier this year, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden announced sanctions on Moscow and expelled 10 Russian diplomats. In response, the Russian Federation announced that it was sanctioning several high-ranking U.S. officials and expelling 10 American diplomats. Right now, the U.S. and Russia have withdrawn their ambassadors from their respective capitals. Such tit-for-tat actions have resulted in a dramatic reduction in the diplomatic footprint in Moscow and Washington, making it very difficult to even conduct basic diplomacy.
Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two superpowers around the world. Ties between the United States and Russia are once again under the spotlight as the U.S. president and his Russian counterpart are scheduled to meet next week. During their upcoming meeting, the American president is expected to raise very touchy issues with the Russian leader. Those sore points include allegations of Russian interference in American elections and Moscow's involvement in Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. This week, Biden had tough words for Russia just days ahead of the high-stakes Geneva meeting. He warned that Moscow faces robust and meaningful consequences if it engages in, quote, harmful activities.
What the United States is trying to do is to act like they are tough for domestic consumption. You know, what goes on between the two leaders, what exactly Biden would be afraid of, we don't know. What worries United States the most is the whole situation with Ukraine, because United States put all their bets and all their sort of cards and all their money into Ukraine.
Before Biden sits down for talks with Putin in Geneva, he is consulting with European leaders at the G7 in Britain and the NATO summit in Brussels. Biden is expected to try to build pressure on the Russian Federation. America views Russia as the second most serious threat after China. While former U.S. President Donald Trump tried to avoid penalizing Russia on the world stage, in his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed new sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden seems intent on taking a tougher line on Moscow. How will Putin react? The Russian leader is known for refusing to back down. The upcoming meeting in Geneva may not produce a breakthrough, but its outcome will probably provide a hint about the future course of relations between the two rivals.
At first, it was dismissed as a conspiracy theory, but now the idea is gaining traction and international attention. The coronavirus, or COVID-19, as it became known, may have originated from a laboratory in Wuhan. This was a claim that former U.S. President Donald Trump had stated, in which he received a lack of flak for calling it a Chinese virus. But what has led to a rise in this theory? The fact that the virus leaked out of a laboratory in Wuhan was never really dismissed outright in the first place. Now, a report on the origins of COVID-19 by a U.S. government national laboratory concluded that the hypothesis of a virus leak from a Chinese lab in Wuhan is plausible and deserves further investigation.
My take is that the American government is changing its attitude from time to time and aimed more at being anti-Donald Trump and anti-China than anything else. It does not recognize that it really was a biowarfare weapon, as I and others firmly believe.
This was apparent when, as recent as last week, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that the intelligence needs to be gathered as to the origins of the virus. U.S. intelligence agencies are considering two likely scenarios: that the virus resulted from a laboratory accident, or that it emerged from a human contact with an infected animal. Meanwhile, U.S. government sources said a classified American intelligence report circulated during the Trump administration, which alleged that the three researchers at China's Wuhan Institute of Virology became so ill in November 2019 that they sought hospital care. U.S. officials have accused China of not being transparent about the virus's origin, a charge Beijing denies.
The U.S. moves to shift the blame of COVID-19 is no different from its lies in Iraq's position of weapons of mass destruction. The international community should be vigilant about this. I'm sure such moves will be rejected by people with insight. We urge the U.S. to stop politicizing this study of origins, stop smearing China, adopt an open and transparent attitude on this issue, shoulder its due responsibilities, and invite WHO experts for origin studies in the U.S.
Numerous numerous questions arises out of all of this, and the one that clearly needs to be answered is, why is the U.S. president highlighting the results of the intelligence findings at this point in time? Was he not aware of the intelligence reports like during the time Trump was in power?
My take, again, is that Biden was and the Democratic Party were doing this as a result of their opposition to Trump and to make him look bad. He's now involved in investigating this because it makes China look bad, and China is now the new enemy.
Furthermore, the WHO at one point clearly rejected the hypothesis that the virus was a result of a laboratory break or to have originated from a lab in Wuhan. It even had a team in Wuhan to investigate this, and the head of the World Health Organization mission said it was, quote, extremely unlikely that the virus spread from a lab leak in the city of Wuhan. Now, after over a year of the outbreak, several Western powers and prominent scientists have publicly stated as woefully inadequate the findings of the WHO. They have stated that those findings were relied on data collected by Chinese officials. This has led to many to conclude that the U.S. is taking political advantage of this in order to gain points against China.
Well, yes, indeed. The U.S. is doing this to obtain political advantage over China, to paint them as an enemy, has ignored its own involvement in the matter in the past, and is ignoring its own flip-flopping over the last year and a half or so.
The U.S. and China are competing in several arenas on the world stage, from sensitive issues like Taiwan and the South China Sea to intelligence like 5G. The U.S. has labeled China as its biggest national security threat. Whether it would at this length to falsely level an accusation of this magnitude remains to be seen.
It was a march that never happened on the occupied territories. Israeli settlers were supposed to hold a flags march in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, but it looked like as soon as the flags march was announced, it was canceled. The reason? Hamas threatened to activate its missiles. All this was preceded by warnings and threats issued by the Palestinian resistance, where the head of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar, stressed that if the confrontation with Israel erupts again, the shape of the Middle East will be different from what it is now. Sinwar stressed that the resistance is able to achieve deterrence and was able to make possible the accumulated force. Based on the order of how the announcement was then rescinded after Hamas made this threat, it appears that Israel has surrendered to Hamas. This conclusion is also based on Israel's loss to the Palestinian resistance faction's victory over the Israeli regime recently in the 11-day war. Israel had to surrender, stop the war, and then go to Egypt to broker a permanent ceasefire. The U.S. administration also weighed in and called on Israel not to take steps that would ignite the situation in Jerusalem.
To say that there's a permanent ceasefire, I think, is dreaming. There has never been a permanent ceasefire, and there won't be one until the siege ends and the occupation ends and there's justice for Palestinians. So again, I think that that is really hyperbole. I do believe that the U.S. pressured Israel and said, you have done enough and time to stop. But again, we've seen this pattern over and over and over again, and so I am not particularly optimistic. I think there was also pressure because of the issue around the different parties trying to coalesce around toppling Netanyahu, and that fed into the outcome.
The situation in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds remains tense, especially in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. From forced evictions to the detainment of activists, the occupied neighborhood remains a tinderbox. Most recently, Israel detained a prominent female Palestinian activist in a raid on her home in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Mona Al-Kord leads the Safe Jarrah campaign. It's a campaign which has been trying to mobilize actions against Israel's plan to displace dozens of Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. She was released days later, but the evictions still continue, and hence the violent clashes between Palestinian resistance and Israeli occupying forces. Israel has been under heavy pressure from the resistance groups in Gaza and Lebanon. Days ago, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah Resistance Movement, warned Israel that any aggression on holy sites in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds would lead to regional war and destruction of the Tel Aviv regime.
Well, I do think that attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque are incredibly dangerous and would ignite a tremendous amount of rage amongst Muslims all over the world and potentially a regional war. And I think it is very important that Israel not do this, and it would be catastrophic. Again, I cannot emphasize enough that Israel is a massive military power with nuclear weapons, with U.S. backing, and there have been many instances in the past where Arab nations have threatened to, quote, destroy Israel, and they have been quite unsuccessful. So I think we have to be very realistic in terms of the level of military might that Israel has, given the history of the region.
Furthermore, a report has revealed that both Hamas and Hezbollah chiefs had discussed a plan for the liberation of all Palestine. This was discussed last year and prior to the 11-day war. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza war was part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during 2006 war by setting up mock rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. Yemen's Ansarullah also communicated with Hamas and requested coordinates for the site it wanted to target with missiles and drones, but Hamas told the popular movement not to intervene as long as the Israeli army had not crossed the red lines. Now, with a new cabinet being formed in Israel, this should serve as warning to the incoming administration to make sure the rights of Palestinians will not be violated and Palestinians will be allowed to pray in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinians, however, are not holding their breath. They are rest assured, however, that resistance groups like Hamas and Hezbollah have their backs.
Tensions are growing between the West and Belarus after Minsk scrambled a fighter jet to divert the flight path of a Lithuania-bound Ryanair passenger plane and forced it to land late last month. Minutes after the landing, Belarusian authorities arrested 26-year-old opposition blogger Roman Protasevich and his fiancé who were on the plane. The move infuriated the European Union and the United States.
And Belarus used its control over its airspace in order to perpetrate a state hijacking. Therefore, the safety and security of flights through Belarus airspace can no longer be trusted.
During a summit in Brussels, EU leaders urged carriers based on the bloc to avoid flying over Belarus. In addition, they have agreed to ban Belarusian airlines from using the bloc's airspace and airports. The 27-nation bloc has slammed more economic sanctions on Belarus. The EU says it has indefinitely frozen a 3 billion euro investment package for the country. Minsk's move has been slammed by some EU leaders as, quote, state piracy.
Essentially, Belarus is very highly aligned to Russia, and that is the choice that they made. Well, this doesn't sit well with U.S. imperialist efforts who want to see all, essentially all countries in the world allied to them and subservient to them. Now, this is part of a larger U.S. strategy to try to encircle Russia within Europe. As we know that the current Ukrainian crisis is going on right now, where NATO-aligned forces are going to be fighting Russian-aligned and full-on Russian forces probably sometime in mid-June when the permafrost finally melts and it's more advantageous to move large vehicles across Ukraine. Belarus is allied to Russia.
Belarus says it requested the emergency landing due to a suspected bomb threat on the plane. The airliner then left Minsk for its destination in Lithuania shortly after. In a video broadcast by Belarusian state media, Roman Protasevich said he was in good health and cooperating with the country's officials.
Hello, my name is Roman Protasevich. I was detained yesterday at the Minsk National Airport. I'm now in the Minsk Detention Center number 1. I can say that I don't have any health issues, including heart or any other organs disease. Police officers treat me properly and according to the law. Also, I now continue to cooperate with the investigation and give a confession on organizing mass protests in Minsk.
The opposition was quick to reject the statement, arguing that Protasevich was confessing under duress.
But Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has denied any wrongdoing, accusing the West of seeking to provoke unrest in his country. In a meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, Lukashenko said the West is trying to, quote, rock the boat to cause a new round of protests against his government. He was referring to the outbreak of protests after the 2020 presidential election, when his opponent and Western countries accused his government of voter fraud. President Putin has also warned the West against meddling in Belarus's internal affairs. He also dismissed speculations that Russia participated in diverting the airliner.
This isn't simply someone being targeted by a country for, you know, whatever reason. There is a very clear process here. Person is wanted for a crime, and if they pass through the country, then they are going to be stopped. I mean, this is not even comparable to, say, Chinese Huawei CFO who was stopped in Canada for a crime that doesn't even exist there.
The recent incident wasn't the first that led to rising tensions between the West and Belarus, which is in a union state with Russia, and will certainly not be the last.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight. A Baltimore factory that rendered useless 75 million doses of a coronavirus vaccine developed by Johnson & Johnson failed for weeks to seal off a preparation area for vaccine ingredients and allowed production waste to be hauled through the area, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said in a memorandum analyzing the plant's operations. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Sharon Lafreniere. The piece is titled, FDA Details Failures at a Baltimore Plant That Led to Unusable Vaccine Doses. Baltimore factory that rendered useless 75 million doses of a coronavirus vaccine developed by Johnson & Johnson failed for weeks to seal off a preparation area for vaccine ingredients and allowed production waste to be hauled through the area, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said in a memorandum analyzing the plant's operations. The memorandum, posted on the agency's website late on Friday, 11th of June, offered the most extensive explanation to date of why regulators believe that tens of millions of doses of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine produced at that factory in Baltimore must be discarded. The FDA advised Johnson & Johnson on Friday that it should throw out the equivalent of 60 million doses of the vaccine. That brought to 75 million the total number of doses that cannot be used because of concerns about contamination at a southeastern Baltimore plant operated by Emergent BioSolutions, Johnson & Johnson's subcontractor and a longtime government contractor. The vaccine-making factory has been shut for the past 2 months, while regulators determined the cause of the contamination that ruined many doses, whether it is safe to reopen the facility, and what to do with the equivalent of at least 170 million doses of the vaccine that Emergent produced for Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, another vaccine developer. The Food and Drug Administration's FDA's memo stated that Emergent failed to properly segregate zones in which workers manufactured vaccines developed by Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca in order to prevent cross-contamination that could render doses unsafe or ineffective. It was written by Dr. Peter Marks, the FDA's top vaccine regulator, and was addressed to Johnson & Johnson. When Emergent first began producing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in November of last year, the memo stated the plant's workers weighed and readied ingredients used to produce the two vaccines in separate areas. But once the factory began full production in December, workers began weighing and clearing materials for both vaccines in a common warehouse. At the same time, the accelerated pace of production created more waste. Emergent allowed workers to tote it through the warehouse in wheeled containers, according to the FDA's report and interviews with former Emergent workers familiar with the plant's procedures. That mistake is most likely to blame for Emergent's discovery in March that a batch of Johnson & Johnson vaccine had been contaminated with a key ingredient used to manufacture the AstraZeneca vaccine, the memo stated. Emergent said weeks ago that it had discarded that entire batch of vaccines, the equivalent of 15 million doses. On Friday, 11th of June, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, decided that an additional 60 million Johnson & Johnson doses should not be used. The agency said it considered a separate 10 million doses to be safe, effective, and suitable for distribution in the United States or for export. Emergent and Johnson & Johnson have both cast the clearance of those doses as a positive development that will help fight the pandemic. The memo said that the contamination discovered in March most likely occurred when workers removing waste from AstraZeneca's production zone tainted bioreactor materials that were being readied for use in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Besides the 15 million doses that had to be tossed out, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said an additional 60 million doses of the vaccine should be discarded because the same lax procedures were used in producing them and evidence of trace contamination might not have shown up in tests. There is no evidence that even a low level of contamination would have no impact on the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine, the memo said. Even though the plant did not fully follow good manufacturing practices, regulators decided to clear 10 million doses of the vaccine, citing the continuing COVID-19 public health emergency. Those batches were produced under better conditions before the overloading of the facility's capacities and the transit of waste in the area that led to the cross-contamination, the memo stated. The agency also underscored the fact that regulators were concerned about emergence practices before the contaminated batch was discovered. In September of last year, it stated inspectors cited manufacturing areas crowded with equipment and supplies, inadequate support for quality assurance, and a need to improve the flow of materials and equipment at the plant. During a follow-up visit in early February of this year, inspectors were troubled by the number of personnel changes and new hires, as well as the need for more consistency in following manufacturing procedures, the memo said. The U.S. government agreed in May of 2020 to pay Emergent monthly fees that, as of this April, would have totaled about $200 million. A federal official said the Biden administration has not been paying the Emergent fees, which were tied to production of the AstraZeneca vaccine, since about April. After the contamination was discovered, federal officials stripped Emergent of the responsibility of producing AstraZeneca's vaccine. If and when the factory is allowed to reopen, Emergent will only produce the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and only under Johnson & Johnson's direct supervision. A decision on whether the Baltimore plant can resume its operations is expected in a few weeks' time.
Syrians have taken to the polls and re-elected Bashar al-Assad as president of the Syrian Arab Republic for a fourth consecutive term. With an extraordinary turnout rate and landslide victory, the West has actively sought to undermine the election and the will of the Syrian people. So what does this victory mean for Syria's 10-year resistance against regime change and against imperialism? And what tactics have Western nations resorted to in order to discredit and sabotage Syria's presidential elections? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On May 26, 2021, Syrians took to the polls to vote in the second presidential elections since the start of the war on Syria in 2011. A month earlier, in April, 14 candidates had been approved to run by the People's Assembly. Bashar al-Assad, candidate of the Ba'ath Party, won in a landslide victory of 95.2%. The turnout was an astonishing 78.6%, which is very high under any circumstances, never mind for a country under siege. After the results of the elections were announced on May 27th, Syrians went out to celebrate, taking to the streets in droves.